National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire Community News from coast to coast to coast. Brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. And we're your hosts, Mina Ramos and Jesse Winokur.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on Attawandaron Neutral Territory in Guelph, Ontario at CFRU 93.3 FM. In this episode, Kaylee McKnight and Max Scott comment on the recent awarding of $60,000 in damages to an immigration detainee and what it means for the future of detainees organizing against immigration detention. We'll also hear from Gabrielle Alahuda, a seasonal agricultural worker who testified at the Federal Review on the Temporary Foreign Workers Program and the results of Michael Sona's appeal following his conviction in the robocall scandal of 2011.
But first, here are the headlines.
On Sunday, May 8th, over 1,000 people gathered on Fort William First Nations, Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay for the Heartbeat of the Drum Walk for Healing. The organizer, Cree Elder Francis Wesley, envisioned having 500 traditional drummers celebrating the role that drumming has in spiritual healing. The walk was led by Indigenous youth from Kisechewan who had been evacuated from their community to Thunder Bay. Following the walk for healing, drumming continued at the waterfront as participants circled around a drumming group and a youth drumming group in the center. Elders spoke about the high rates of suicide amongst Indigenous youth, missing and murdered Indigenous women, and then a feast was commenced.
After the recent death of an immigration detainee at the Edmonton Remand Center, 130 healthcare professionals have signed onto a petition to demand that immigration detainees stop being transferred to provincial jails where they are held indefinitely. The Canadian government has been quoted saying that they can and must do better, but Corinne Baki of the South Asian Legal Clinic of Ontario is skeptical that the government has any real plans to address the issue of deaths in immigration detention.
Given that there's been 15 people to have died in immigration custody since 2000, CBSA has not done anything to really respond. It keeps happening. The most recent death that occurred last Saturday in Edmonton was the third in 2 months. So this is really out of control. Luckily, the issue is gaining some traction, but instead what the government's basically doing is trying to find out ways to make immigration detention not quite as bad and maybe a little bit more quote-unquote humane. But the fact is, people should not be detained for not having the right papers, period.
The coroner's inquest into the killing of Jermaine Carby by the Peel Regional Police in Brampton has shed light on details that were formerly kept secret, including the identity of the police officer who shot Jermaine Carby and the fact that Carby was carted when he was initially stopped on September 19, 2014. Since his death, family members, supported by several different communities and organizations, have called for justice and have pointed to the unsettling discrepancies involved in his case. LaTanya Grant, cousin of Jermaine Carby, commented that the discrepancies demonstrate just how deeply systemic racism has affected how Carby's case has been handled.
These officers blatantly lied on the stand. I mean, stories were getting mixed up. There were so many inconsistencies, and I'm just shocked that these things are even occurring in our justice system. We know that there's systemic racism, but when you're seeing it right in front of your face play out, you get a whole different picture that this is even bigger than you. And I'm happy that I was able to get the information that I needed out of the inquest. We now know, to a certain extent, apart from the lies, what really happened that night and what we're going to be doing moving forward.
This spring, members of the Anishinaabe community of Grassy Narrows will be traveling 1,700 kilometers to Toronto from their home just north of Kenora, Ontario. They're coming to demand action from Kathleen Wynne and the Ontario government. In the 1960s, local pulp mills dumped 9,000 kilograms of mercury into the Wabagoon River, which contaminated the fish and triggered an ongoing health crisis in the downstream community. People have lived with the immense effects of the pollution ever since. The Women's Drum Group has successfully maintained the longest-running blockade of illegal logging in Canadian history. On Thursday, June 2nd, people are invited to join the Women's Drum Group and other members of the community in Toronto for the 4th Annual River Run, a mass action to assert Grassy Narrows' sovereignty and demand accountability from the Ontario government. This is Grassy Narrows community member Chrissy Swain speaking at a panel discussion in the lead-up to the 2014 River Run.
You know, it's everybody's responsibility, not just us. We all have to say something. We all have to stand up together, not alone, together. All the nations, not just the Red Nation, everybody has to stand up.
Last weekend, media activists converged in Orillia at Lakehead University, coming from all over Canada and the world, to attend a conference hosted by the Media Action Research Group. The opening roundtable featured an activist from Black Lives Matter about their troubled interaction with mainstream media who distorted coverage of their protests and goals.
We wanted this one opportunity for us to talk about what this meant for us, for Black people. Literally that little portion of the about page blew up. The mainstream media will take whatever it is that you were doing and flip it around on you.
Sheila spoke about the value of serving marginalized communities with her media.
I think for us, it's actually not so much about numbers. We're not there for everybody. I think we actually want to be there for youth when they feel alienated by the world.
The Media Activists Research Conference was streamed and archived online at mediaactionresearch.org.
Black Lives Matter by Debbie Young, a Toronto-based artist who just finished the three-week production of her show, She Mami Wata and the Pussy Witch Hunt. The show is the second part of a trilogy and received wide appraise from critics such as Now Magazine. Now, it's time for our featured news. On Monday, May 16th, four migrant workers testified at the Standing Committee on Human Resources, Skills, and Social Development and the Status of Persons with Disabilities as part of a federal review of the Temporary Foreign Workers Program. In recent years, the Temporary Foreign Workers Program has received wide scrutiny by migrant advocacy organizations who state that the wide array of issues within the program has created a labor system within Canada built on racism, sexism, and classism. In an interview, Gabriel Alahuda, a seasonal agricultural worker who testified at the hearing, spoke about the importance of speaking out at the hearing and the issues he feels need to be changed at a political level.
It was important that I present the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. This year, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of this program, and there are lots of issues. We have a contract that is not enforceable. Our work permit is tied to one employer. Imagine our employer controls our housing. And, you know, just that alone tells you how precarious we are. Constantly, we face harassment. The moment you get sick or injured on the job, you've been sent home. We consistently make our contributions to EI, and we can't access those benefits. When it comes to the program itself, it is very clear to us that they want to perpetuate 18th century working conditions. From the workers' standpoint, the fact that we are physically separated from our families, it makes our trouble worse. It contributes to the breakdown of our families, and also it contributes to the vicious cycle of poverty and social ills. These are things I can tell you so much about because personally, I'm experiencing it right now. And the changes that we want, it must be at the political level because the problems we have, they are deep in the system, it's systemic, and the solution lies in changing the laws. And that is why it was critical that I voiced the views of my colleagues. We seldom have opportunities to do that.
Although Alajuda highlighted the importance of being represented at the hearing, he also expressed that there were several shortcomings to the federal review of the program, citing that he felt that the review was a formality rather than a vehicle for policy change.
I only had 7 minutes to share with another colleague. This review that's going on, it is very rushed, and it is not a review really. It is just a formality. They do not want to hear from people that have been impacted. To me, that is not a review. It is just something to please the public, to give the impression that something has been done. The fact that it wasn't televised is also confirming that the people at the top, they want to perpetuate the system as it is right now. Canada prides itself as a place of diversity. It prides itself as a place of safe refuge. It prides itself as a place where everyone is guaranteed human rights. But in practice, it is like a different Canada. They give one impression. In practice, this is not a reality, you know?
Hassan of the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change, who is also in attendance, contends that the federal review was not set up to actually include workers at all and is not sure that any legislative change will come out of the recommendations made from the review.
The fact is that these consultations are taking place in Ottawa. The very, very complicated multiple levels of programs are essentially only getting about 12 hours of witness time where people can come and make presentations. It's a closed process. The parliamentarians decide who should appear. Witnesses get at most seven minutes. And the vast majority of so-called witnesses are, in fact, industry lobbyists and corporations. Now, the workers that did appear were largely speaking about their own experiences. It is unacceptable and ununderstandable to us that a review of the temporary foreign worker program doesn't prioritize temporary foreign workers themselves, which shows the nature of a system where migrant workers are seen as commodities. So the conversation then becomes how many workers and where should they work? Now, many of these workers were largely ignored by the Liberal and Conservative parliamentarians who were in the room, who chose not to ask them any questions. Now, whether their recommendations and their experiences will make the final report, that remains to be seen.
Although the government is under no obligation to implement the recommendations that come out of the federal review, Hassan hopes that the review will shift the dialogue around migrant workers and the temporary foreign workers program in general.
The review is going to make a set of recommendations, but those recommendations may not necessarily become legislation or regulation. The government has absolutely no compulsion. It has no compulsion to actually follow these recommendations. So what we're hoping out of this process is a few things. One, we want a clear understanding that the core issues can only be solved by permanent immigration status on landing for all new workers and permanent immigration status for workers in the country and those who've been injured and have had to move out or become undocumented. Second, we want this to be a moment to honor and celebrate the work of migrant workers and really center the fact that migrant workers have been a critical part of this, our society, our community for centuries. And third, we want to really have a common conversation across this country about the role of displacement. Why is it that people are forced to leave their homes in the first place? That is to do with Canadian foreign policy, Canadian international trade policy, etc. Those are the conversations we want to have. Now, legislative changes other than status or landing, if that's not possible, we do have a series of policy recommendations that include open work permits. I mean, simple as that. Everyone should be able to leave a job that's making them sick, right? Everyone should be able to leave a job where they're facing abuse. And migrant workers do not have this simple freedom. And we are insisting that it is already too late and that change should happen immediately.
An immigration detainee at Maplehurst Correctional Center in Milton has been awarded $60,000 after Superior Court of Justice Douglas Gray ruled that he was subjected to, quote, cruel and unusual punishment, and that his rights to freedom were seriously violated. Detainees at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, have been organizing specific actions since 2013, such as refusing to enter into their cells, in order to protest the frequent lockdowns that they are subjected to. Working to support them from the outside is Kaylee McKnight of the End Immigration Detention Network, who witnessed the detainees' reactions to the recent win.
They're pretty excited because it's not very often that they see our so-called justice system working in their favor or challenging a lot of the injustices that they're used to seeing. And the other pretty exciting piece about this win is that the people who won did it by filing a habeas corpus motion to protest their frequent lockdowns. And the fact that immigration detainees can file a habeas corpus is something that a lot of the guys that I'm in contact with in the Central East have been organizing around for quite some time.
Kaylee provided insight as to why these lockdowns are such a significant problem in immigration detention.
A lot of what these guys are doing on a daily basis, and women as well, is trying to figure out what's going on with their cases. They're trying to get out of detention, contact their lawyers, contact their families, and when they're on lockdown frequently, they're not able to do that. Many meetings with lawyers have to be canceled or rescheduled because detainees are being held for lockdown. They're in their cells for up to 21 plus hours a day. When you're stuck in a cell, you're not able to walk around, go outside. All you can do is think about when you might be able to get out.
Kaylee spoke about what immigration detention is actually like on the inside compared to the stereotypes presented by mainstream media.
The Central East Correctional Center, Maplehurst, and Toronto East are all maximum security prisons. Not necessarily what we're used to seeing on TV. Many times when immigration detainees are being held in maximum security prisons, it's also their first time being held in a prison. You have to eat on a forced schedule. You're going to the washroom in front of people on a forced schedule at times, especially when you're on lockdown. Programming is something that's very limited. The immigration detainees don't have access to educational programming. They just recently got one day a month where they get to visit the gym facilities. I've heard they were locked down from Friday till Tuesday. So that's almost a full week of being stuck in one cell with one person. There's many weeks where you'll get out maybe one day a week, and then you're locked down for days at a time again.
Max Scott, a paralegal who currently represents several immigration detainees, spoke in more detail about what the recent successful application of the habeas corpus means for the future of detainees to be able to fight their lockdowns.
Where you're being detained, you can ask a court to bring the state forward and prove why they should hold you under the situation that they're holding you. One of the amazing things is that the two men represented themselves. This shows a couple of things. It shows that the current campaign to try and curb the terribleness of Canada's immigration detention system is being led by people on the inside. And number two, it shows that these folks are motivated, they're smart, and they're organized, and the state should be scared. What this case says is you can't just prod over someone's human rights because you have labor problems, because you have a lot of guards going on vacation. And I'm looking forward to when there's a class action suit by all the folks in Lindsay suing the heck out of the government for treating them like crap over the last 10, 20 years. I think across Ontario, and I think it will go nationwide eventually, detainees are going to go into the court, they're going to demand reparations and damages for all the time that they spend in lockdown. They're going to get that money because they're going to win. And that money will go to their families. That money will hopefully help them when they get set free. And they're going to end the lockdown system. Hopefully what this will also lead towards is our other demand and the detainees' demand that they not be held in maximum security. They're being held for administrative law breaches, not even crimes. And they're being held in maximum security. They shouldn't be held in these provincial jails. They should be held somewhere else. And in fact, they should not be held at all. I think what I love about this is that they went ahead and they did it themselves. Like those two guys did it themselves. Mm-hmm. They didn't wait for the lawyers. They didn't wait for the movement. They went forward and they fought. And that's what we've seen, I think, since the hunger strike of the 191 is that, you know, we are a sideshow. They are organized and they are fighting and the government should be scared. When the victory comes, and it's going to come, we're going to end at least indefinite immigration detention. Eventually, I think we're going to end immigration detention, period. And it's going to be them. They did it. They're doing it.
On Wednesday, May 18th, Michael Sohn entered the Ontario Court of Appeal in Toronto to hear whether or not he was going to spend more time in jail or whether he'd be serving the original 9-month sentence he was given in November 2014. It was the latest in a long journey that began May 2nd, 2011, when 7,000 people in Guelph got a robocall the morning of the federal election to tell them that the polling station given to them on the voter information card had been changed. In an unusual circumstance befitting an unusual case, Sona's sentence was being appealed on two fronts. Sona's lawyer, Howard Kronkeld, argued that his client's sentence should be reduced, calling Sona in the factum he filed with the court a good young man of great promise who was brought to his knees as a result of his terrible decision. In his decision in 2014, Justice Gary Hearn convicted Sona of preventing or endeavoring to prevent an elector from voting on the basis that he aided and abetted the person known only as Pierre Poutine in placing the Guelph robocalls. Justice Hearn said Sona was actively involved as the creator of the plan. For that reason, Crown Prosecutor Nicholas E. Devlin argued that Sona should serve more time in jail. In the end, though, no jail time for Sona is going to satisfy those touched by the robocall fraud in 2011. Unanswered questions abound, and according to Cornelis Cleverling, the marijuana candidate for Guelph in 2011, who was at Osgoode Hall to hear Sona's appeal, he believes that the case is more important than fraud.
You know what Section 3 means under the Charter, the right to a free and fair election, everyone has the right to vote. All of that was like up for grabs because of what Sona and others did, and that was never heard. That Charter issue, up to this very day, was never heard. And it wasn't heard when Sona's appeal occurred a few days ago. The Crown was speaking, oh, well, you know, he injured democracy, this and that. Yes, he did that, but what about the Charter issue itself? It was not raised.
Ultimately, both denials were turned down by the three-judge panel. For Clevering, it was a case of political expediency.
And it was clear to me that they want to forget this matter and get it out of the court as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. I honestly do, Adam. And this whole issue of, putting our democratic system under the microscope, that makes them very uncomfortable.
Also disappointed by how the case has turned out is Sarah Parrow. Parrow is one of the 7,000 people that got the call on E-Day 2011, and she filed a victim impact statement during Sona's initial sentencing phase in 2014.
I do feel disappointed with how it has been handled and how I feel it hasn't been taken as seriously as it should, but as a public voter, it's unfortunate that for future elections, I feel that I have to stay nonpartisan to not be targeted again for another situation.
Adding a more tragic hue to the story was the revelation in the defense factum and an article by Michael Harris on iPolitics that Sona considered taking his own life in the weeks after Sun News leaked his name as a suspect in the robocalls case. Para is sympathetic, Clevering, however, less so.
I do feel like he is put into a scapegoat. It would not shock me to find out that there are people hiding behind him to essentially sweep whatever happened under the rug. It makes me even more upset that all of the spotlight is on this young man.
I don't feel sympathetic for him at all. What? Why? Has he been remorseful? Has he apologized? Has he said, oh, this is a terrible thing that I did? No, he's kept his mouth shut. He hasn't shown any indication of the impact and the effect of what he did.
Clevering tried to launch a court action to get the results of the 2011 election in Guelph overturned, a journey that took him all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And though he can't take the court action any further now, his last appeal was denied in December. He still wants to keep pressing on the government and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to fulfill promises of electoral reform.
I'll sleep a lot better when Justin Trudeau does what he said he would, that he would change the Free Elections Act and would give, the electoral officer more power for prosecution and investigation in the future, should this ever happen again. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if it does happen again, well, who's going to be held accountable?
Para, meanwhile, wants us to keep in mind that this wasn't just a crime against one person or one group of people. It was more fundamental than that.
I want them to know that it's not right to take rights away from the citizens. Not right to take that freedom away. we live in a free country. I get very emotional about this because sure. When it comes to living in a free country, it's just very annoying when there are certain powers that be that just abuse
Sona is to this date the only person charged, tried, and convicted for involvement in the electoral fraud scheme that not only affected the riding of Guelph, but other electoral districts across the country as well.
For the Groundwire Community Radio Report, I'm Brian Webb with CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario. In 2014, CFRU was awarded a grant to build a mobile broadcast studio. The mobile studio consists of a broadcast mixer, a folding table with mic mounts, three mics, CD players, a telephone hybrid, and a laptop, all of which fit in a rolling case and can be set up anywhere with a power outlet in about 20 minutes. In 2015, the station hired a mobile studio coordinator, Jenny Mitchell, to coordinate outreach, find suitable locations for community engagement, and help community members feel at home on the air. I met with Jenny Mitchell at the mobile studio's current location, a neighborhood group space in Guelph's West End, to discuss her experience overseeing this ongoing project.
I think that my role is it's sort of the community piece of campus and community radio. There was maybe a feeling that there are voices that we weren't capturing by being located only on campus. I like to think of my job as sort of I'm on like a reconnaissance mission of community voice collecting. So I come out into these different neighborhood groups. I basically try to get to know them and form actual, trusting, meaningful relationships so that it'll culminate in a radio show. We have generally been working kind of in partnership with the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition. Each neighborhood has its own unique requirements in terms of programming and resources. Some places need food more, some places need after-school care more. We're really lucky because we have one group that sort of listens to the needs and responds to them accordingly. And then the programming coordinators and the parent outreach workers, we reach like youth groups. Like there's the Indigo Girls group, which is like a group of preteens that get together. And so those girls got to come on and make an hour-long radio episode. There's been kind of a number of programs like that. There's some direct programming, but I think the more interesting thing is the spiraling out. Like every person that you meet has 10 more stories that they're connected to, and then those people have more stories. And so the longer we stay, the more sort of deep you can go into some of those little branches that you start to clear. People will make the argument that they haven't heard themselves on the radio, and they'll use it as an excuse as to why they think they don't belong. And that's one of the first things I try to do when I come to coffee hours, turn that around and say, if you haven't heard yourself on the radio, that's why you should be on the radio.
You've been listening to Jenny Mitchell, CFRU's mobile studio coordinator, speak about the station's mobile studio project. For more information about this initiative, visit the project's website, cfrumobile.com. or email mobile@cfru.ca. This is Brian Webb with the Groundwire Community Radio Report from CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario.
That was an excerpt of the song Find Safety by the Toronto-based group Lal from their newly released album, also called Find Safety. That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Again, this edition was co-hosted and produced by Mina Ramos and Jesse Winokur at CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Headlines this week were written by Carly Forbes, Mandy Hiscox, and Ome Salma Rahimtula. We'd also like to thank Christopher Curry and Savannah Clark, Adam Nicholson, and Brian Webb and Jenny Mitchell. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ca.